Hello and welcome to Best Practice Network Apprenticeship Podcast. I'm Tasha Singleton, the program lead for the Early Years Senior Leader Apprenticeship, and I am joined by my co-host, Emma Mancella, our Deputy Curriculum Manager. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Tasha.
Hey. And today we are discussing analysis and evaluation and taking that from writing to real-world practice and what that looks like in respect to strategic thinking and planning. And we are joined today by Dr. Gemma Ryder, who is the senior lecturer at the University of East London. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you here. We're thrilled to have your expertise, that bit of academic input, you know, about how we can use analysis and evaluation to support us in our daily work, really. So can you tell us, Gemma, just a little bit more about your background and your experience?
Yes, of course. So 30 years ago, I was actually studying for the NNEB Diploma in Nursery Nursing in college, and I was interested in working with young children. And once I'd completed my qualification, I went to work for several years in a private day nursery and worked my way up to a room leader position. And shortly after that, an interesting opportunity came up for a local job in the college I trained at to arrange work experience for students that were on early years courses. And this ranged all the way from level one, because they'd introduced this foundation level one course, all the way up to level three. And this enabled me to work with quite a wide range of different professionals in the sector. So my role was to build positive relationships with the settings. Obviously, I stepped into a support capacity because we would sometimes have challenges with some students that might be having personal difficulties or academic difficulties. And so this enabled me to work with teachers, head teachers. We had health visitors that would help us arrange family placements for students. And we also had students that were organising their own placements in playgroups, children's centres and so on. So already this started to give me quite an interesting insight into different provision and structures across early childhood education and care. And after, again, a few years working at the college, I decided I wanted to have a go at developing myself as a professional. And back then, they didn't have any early years degrees in the way that they are run now. They were very much focused on teacher training, which is something I didn't really want to do because I like to work with the 0 to 5 years age group. So I ended up doing a health science degree. And although it was a very different discipline, it gave me a lot of supportive skills, particularly in relation to reflection, analysis, critical thinking skills. And once I'd finished that, I actually moved out of the area I lived in and ended up doing the early years professional status so I could return to the sector after a few years break. And over the years that followed, I have had, again, more connections with the private and not-for-profit sector. Most of them have been in the capacity of a mix of employment. So I've worked in creches for sure start. I worked in another private day nursery for a short period of time. And my training on my earliest professional status was in a private day nursery and also what was a sure start children's centre, which had on-site day provision. I've also had the opportunity to visit Illinois in America for 2.5 weeks, where I got to visit special education provision, Head Start and Early Head Start, who are not-for-profit organisations working with some of the most vulnerable children and families in society. And once again, that gave me a real eye-opener on different structures, different hierarchies of leadership and management, and also was able to see things I wouldn't have seen when I started work, such as going out into people's homes. And these were quite profoundly impactful because some of them had English as an additional language or very limited English. A couple of them had other challenging circumstances where they were high risk. And so this was a real eye-opener into how different professionals work in the sector. And so now I'm working as a senior lecturer. I've worked my way up. It was a role I never thought I'd do, because from my early beginnings as a nursery nurse, my focus was on working with children. And I didn't really have a clear career path because, again, I wasn't sure if I'd be able to manage a more challenging role in academia. And I've surprised myself over the years by completing my master's, completing my doctorate in education. And now I'm working with students across an entry sort of level three course, which gets them onto their degree program, all the way up to having my own doctoral research students. So it's been quite a journey for me over 30 years, but it's also been very enriching and rewarding to have those connections. And while I am not in practice as such, I do research in the sector. So I'm learning all the time from people that work with children and families, and not just in the UK, but also internationally as well. And that's also been a very rewarding experience to learn a lot from them.
Is your book still in print?
I have two books, actually. I've got one book, which is Leading in Early Childhood, which is 10 years old this year. And I wrote it with one of my tutors, Dr. Geraldine Davis. And we interviewed people that were working in the early childhood sector, mostly in the UK. Some of them had been nannies, professionally trained nannies, or maternity nurses, which is quite an old role. It's not anything to do with midwifery or nursing. It's more of a person that has a lot of experience working with babies that have just been born, and they're round the house 24 hours with the families to help them. And of course, people that are working in nurseries, including managers. I'm currently writing a book that's based on my doctoral thesis and some additional research I did. And that's on something called pro-social behaviour. And it's looking at positive social behaviours across the birth to 8 years age group, because my doctorate was mostly birth to threes, but the international settings I've been interviewing obviously don't always have baby and toddler provision, and some of them are schools where the children are 5 to 8 years. So that's been looking at how pedagogy and curriculum, such as High Scope, Montessori, Bush Kinder, there's lots of others in there as well, how they are supporting and promoting these positive behaviours in children. So this would be things like helping, sharing, showing kindness. So it's not about behaviour management. It's more to do with things like social democracy and citizenship. So I'm hoping that's going to be out later this year.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
That was very inspiring.
She's very inspiring. I think I mentioned that Dr. Gemma was my mentor when I was doing back in the dinosaur ages when I did the early years professional status. So I'm really pleased to have her here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And how beneficial you're going to be to this session today, Gemma.
Absolutely.
It's really exciting.
I think so.
So Gemma, if you don't mind me kickstarting today's discussion, would you be able to just briefly explain to us what we mean by analysis and evaluation?
Yes. So when I explain this to students, obviously we have students that come into our courses that may be unfamiliar with these terms, depending on what discipline they've previously studied and where they've studied. So I like to sort of use some sort of more like descriptors of them. So I always think of analysis like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And so what this means is if you had a jigsaw puzzle, you empty all the pieces out. And when you start looking at them, each piece of that puzzle has something different on there. And so if we think about analysis in practice, when we work with children and families, it's almost looking at things individually, each little piece we explore in detail and consider how they connect to other things. And the finer details here are actually really important, because we might have a particular way of working, or there might be something that we do, and we might need to have some more information on why things are happening the way they are. It might be to do with a child's needs, for example. There might be hidden information that's not always offered by colleagues that we work with or families that we work with. And sometimes we have to understand what those little pieces of information actually mean in terms of what we actually are doing in our practice. So evaluation connects to analysis. So it's almost bringing everything together. It's regularly used when we are exploring the quality of learning and the quality of provision. And so I like to think of them as those, you know, those balancing scales. So we are weighing up different types of information, ideas, and this could be ideas that colleagues share with us. It might be ideas that we've read about or heard about, either through research or maybe the latest trends or discoveries in the sector. And evaluation is important for informing our decision-making processes. So you can't really have them separately. One informs the other. We need analysis to help us understand things in detail and depth, and we need evaluation to then understand what our next steps are and how we're going to use this information. So that would be the way I would explain it to learners and also people perhaps that are career changers that might be new to working in the sector.
So, and of course, we call these our command verbs or command words. When we're writing, we're looking for analysis, we're looking for evaluation. Describing, of course, is also one. But why is it then describing information enough? We're thinking senior level specifically here, senior leaders who are making these strategic decisions. Why isn't describing the information enough? What are we missing without analysis or evaluation?
So I think it's important to acknowledge that describing is very helpful, because there are times where when we work with families, trainees, students and perhaps volunteers and newcomers to the sector, we often have to describe processes and information to them in a way that they'll understand. Because again, as with any discipline, we will have our own jargon, our own technical terms that may not always be accessible to people that are not in the sector or maybe very new to the sector. And so when we are working at senior level, we obviously accumulate a lot of knowledge, and this comes from the multitude of different roles and responsibilities that we now have, because the sector's changed enormously over the decades in terms of what we do now compared to what my colleagues and I would do when we started. So we didn't have the early years foundation stage back then. We were just seeing a curriculum emerge, which was from the national standards. And then we started to see the foundation stage introduced into our setting. As when I was working in colleges, Birth to Three Matters came in. So we had to learn and understand those so we could impart our knowledge onto the students. And so in today's landscape in early childhood education and care, senior level people, you know, whether they're managers, room leaders, directors, or whatever other specific leadership or management role they have to be able, and they have to be confident in articulating reasons behind their decisions and actions. And so if we think about it in terms of, again, perhaps the way a member of staff would work with another at a senior level. So there might be a particular situation, or there might be a particular person that we're working with that presents some form of challenge. It could be a problem or a difficulty that they are facing that is likely to have consequences or implications either for their practice or the way they work with others. And so here we can use analysis and evaluation to explore what is happening, to give us information, to provide context, and also use it as a means of examining what we can actually do actively to make a difference or bring about some form of change. And so description does have a role, but it's important that we dig deeper as we are working. And again, we do have to consider context here, because the way we approach different situations and scenarios may require us to use different skill sets with others.
That's really interesting, Gemma, and really thought-provoking on how we actually use analysis and evaluation. And one of the words that always used to, or one of the command verbs that always used to throw me when I was studying was critical analysis. How does critical analysis change the quality of the decisions that we make rather than just help us to justify them?
I think sometimes people run away when they hear the word critical, because I think the misconception is if you hear the word critical, it means something negative. But if we reframe it as critiquing, so again, it's going back to my earlier point about those weighing scales. We're balancing out different viewpoints and different arguments. And of course, the early childhood sector is constantly evolving. You know, there's always new things being thrown our way, some that we unfortunately don't have much control over, and we have to adapt very quickly to them. And so when we're looking at critical analysis as a concept, it's something that's used to support continuous improvement. So we might be thinking about what's actually working for us. You know, what works, what still works, anything that perhaps needs to be changed or adapted. Do we need to change? You know, there might be things where we think, we've got to keep moving along with everybody else. But there might be things that we do very successfully that perhaps we can keep at this present time and maybe come back to it later on if situations change. So this might be through job roles and responsibilities shifting. It might be through expectations laid out by policy and legislation. And so critical analysis provides us with what we would call a logical, evidence-based approach. And a little comment I just wrote down here, just something that came to mind when I think about critical analysis, is I feel it's changing from the sort of the phrase of "this works because we've always done it this way" to "does this still work in the way we want or need it to? And what alternatives are available to us?" So again, it's all about reframing and rethinking how we work. And a little story I'll share about this, which is a true story of a setting I worked briefly in, is they were consistently outstanding for many years every time they had an Ofsted inspection. And after I left, I started to do more of my postgraduate studies. I saw they'd had a recent Ofsted inspection, and I went to have a look to see how they were doing, and they had dropped from outstanding to good. And I thought, well, that's unusual, because they were really on top of everything that they needed to do. They were, ticking all the right boxes. And a comment that was made by the inspector said something along the lines of that they didn't always give the children time to answer questions. And so this, what they used to work in a very particular way that had worked well for them for many, many years, and they were quite resistant to change. And while this was fine for a period of time, the rest of the sector was moving on, the rest of the sector was adapting. And so when it came to that inspection time, from the brief statement that was on the report, because obviously they don't give like huge amounts on those reports back then, is there was obviously a challenge in relation to the quality of practice. And so here, if the owner and the manager had spent some more time really doing a deep dive into what they did and recognizing that some things were dated, some things perhaps need to be rethought because the way we work with children was changing. There was more discoveries on neuroscience. There has been, particularly in recent years, there's been more written about what we call slow pedagogy, where we give children space and time and working at their pace rather than just expecting them to do things when we feel they're ready to do them. And those, if they had spent that time with that deep dive and had that critical analytical skills, that might have maintained that outstanding judgment from Ofsted, because they would have recognised the need to change practice and adapt, and that then would have had a positive impact on the quality. So I feel this is important for us all to think about, is that we can't stand still in the sector. And even if something works beautifully well, there is going to come a time where things will change around us and we need to change with it.
We were talking about that in one of my virtual classrooms, the senior leader classroom this morning, about embedded cultural sort of practice that people don't want to change because we've always done it this way. So that's interesting. It's interesting. Thank you. So we're thinking about using pieces of evidence, and we can think about this with writing or even just in your, if you're using evidence that you've collated, you've brought it together, you're looking at it. How do you evaluate the strength, the particular strength of that evidence, not just the fact that it's relevant to what you're talking about or writing about? How do you evaluate the strength?
This could be a skill that people can actually develop, because again, I think when you are presented with evidence, and evidence for us comes in many different ways, shapes and forms. So we have evidence from our day-to-day practice. So this would be our observations, it would be planning, it would be mapping children's progression against particular criteria, such as the early years foundation stage or the national curriculum, if you're working in a school, or maybe another curriculum framework such as Montessori or Steiner Waldorf, if you are working in an alternative provision. And so those I call our practice pieces of evidence, things that we collect on a day-to-day basis. However, it's important as well to ensure that we also access evidence in relation to things that are happening to us in the sector. And so we might have reports that are written by organisations that show us things that are happening in the sector that we need to be aware of. Of course, we have academic readings such as journal articles, books, book chapters. There might be academic blogs that people have access to and that also are used as discussion and debating points, which are really good for professional development for topical issues. And when we read something, it can be very easy to take things at face value. You know, this is almost like gospel. This is the truth. And I think to be a good critical analyst in particular, and to be someone that is highly reflective, we need to keep very open-minded with what we read and also what we hear, because there is a risk of bias. And sometimes something we read might be open to a misinterpretation. So if we are reading a newspaper, for example, and they are reporting on a particular study in early years in education, they're only going to capture a snapshot of that particular report. They won't cover the whole report because they won't have the word count for it. And they obviously, for newspapers, they want to have grabbing headlines. They want to say, oh, you know, this works terribly well, or this is really problematic. And so if we read that, we might think, oh, no, you know, all these horrible things are happening, or, you know, this is brilliant, you know, everywhere does this, and not really looking at the bigger picture here. And so in terms of perhaps the strength of evidence, it's about using a mix of evidence. So if a student I'm working with finds a newspaper article that goes to a particular report, I'll always say to them, go and see if you can get that actual report, because that'll give you more information about not only what the discoveries and findings are, but also the alternative perspectives. So there might be problems that haven't been reported in the newspaper, or there might be solutions or recommendations or comments on really good, strong practice that come up through here. And so it's important to have what I call a multiple perspective. If we read something, is there something else that can either back up a statement or a comment that's been made? Or do people have an opposing view? And if so, why? You know, what is the information that we can gather from that? And so it's about building a strong case and also justifying a point. And to be able to justify a point well, particularly if we have to change something in practice, it might be that, you know, a new policy has come out and people are reading it and saying, oh, you know, we're not, you know, we've got to do this, or we've got to learn this and start all over again, and we're not happy. If that has been informed by some form of empirical research where, you know, researchers have gone out, they've done their homework and they've said, you know, we recognise this approach works well for children because, then it's about having that knowledge and evidence to justify why a change might need to happen. So I'll give a little example, if I may, on this. So if we think about when we had sort of years ago, how we have managed behaviour in settings, you know, there was a period where there was a lot of time out. You know, children would perhaps be sat away or excluded in some way. And that probably worked for quite a few years until it was more of a dialogue about, you know, this approach is not always appropriate. And there might be some cases where it might still be needed if a child is perhaps distressed or at risk of injuring themselves. But normally we would have this concept of, you know, that is not something that we would do now. And some of that has come through research. There have been people that have said, you know, this is how it's been done and this is the impact it then actually has. And so it's being informed, it's having information that is ideally evidence-based and accurate. And we can scrutinise it. We can think about, does this information give us the big picture or does it give us enough? Is there information that's hidden or unclear that perhaps we need to investigate further? So it might be something that's quite vague or ambiguous in something we read, or something perhaps we hear on the media, or perhaps read on social media. And it's supportive at this time to think about encouraging our colleagues to be involved in this process of critical analysis. I quite like colleagues at all ages and all stages of their profession to come in, because I think it can end up being very much like a two-tier system where you have all the senior staff and all the more qualified people, you know, degree level, that are all coming together, having these dialogues and conversations and building these critical analytical skills. But then we forget about the junior and lower level trainees and staff who also need to develop these skills later to help them make informed judgments and decisions about their practice as they grow in skill and confidence. So I'd say that's why it's really important to really have those good evaluative skills when we are presented with different information.
So, and I suppose that just boils down to judgment, your own personal judgment. And so when you do have these opposing viewpoints, and I see how you're using them to strengthen or strengthen your own case and showing that you acknowledge that there are differing viewpoints, that you haven't just pretended that they don't exist. How can that shape your argument then, these opposing viewpoints, rather than confuse it?
It can go in two different directions. And I think this is where we have to think about our own personal histories and backgrounds, because sources we access are going to vary. So in terms of studying, this is often through academic readings. Again, you've got it's important to have current literature because things go out of date very quickly. Sometimes I've marked work and I've said to students, you know, use the 2025 early years foundation stage, and I get their work and they've got the 2014 one, and I'm doing a facepalm moment going, why? It's invalid now. It's things like Every Child Matters. We still had students a few years ago using, thinking Every Child Matters was still a current thing, because they found it and they didn't always have the understanding that some of these things have been phased out or replaced with others. And I think some of that is not because of them. It's because it was quite vague. You know, Every Child Matters almost faded away. Even I questioned, what's happened to it? And I had to go and find out and to see what happened.
Just disappeared into the mist, didn't it?
Yeah. Did, and it was really quietly done as well. It wasn't like a big sort of ceremony, like, oh, we're not using it anymore. It's very sort of discreetly done. And so that's not necessarily the fault of the students and the professionals. It is about the access they have to information and knowing where that information is. And so I'd say current literature, as I said, needs to be relevant. It needs to be sufficient in terms of what we need it for. And again, other resources like reports can be helpful, but they may not always be at the sort of quality level we need to scrutinize them fully. But they can be supportive in giving us a sort of a picture of what's happening in the world that we work in. And so when we are looking at sources and viewpoints, again, you might just pick up one thing and the author, or perhaps even the person that's reading or engaging with that source, may have a particular viewpoint. And this could be to do with social or political views. It might be their own personal professional experience has had a lasting impact. So they might be very much refusal or refusing to accept alternative points of view. And so we have to be self-aware of our own biases and prejudices and assumptions. And some of them will be conscious. We may have a very strong view on something, but we also have those unconscious biases that creep in, you know, those perhaps assumptions we make, maybe some stigmas that we have about perhaps the way we work, the things that we do, and they can creep in again quite subtly. And it's important once again to find information on similar topics or subjects that help us see different viewpoints. And I think for me as an academic, that's been really important, is that my own knowledge and understanding of practice has been enriched by people I've spoken to that have given me more insight into things I wouldn't have thought about. And that's to do with the context they work in. So one little example I'll share is that a couple of years ago, I interviewed someone in New Zealand and they run a bush kinder. And they were talking to me about several New Zealand forest school leaders going to Europe to learn about forest school. And I was like, oh, that sounds really nice. And she said it was a colonial problem. And it suddenly hit me as to why, because obviously there was a history of colonialism in Australia and New Zealand. And the view of this educator was that colleagues going to study in Western Europe would sort of come back with knowledge that is based upon Western identity and Western culture, and not considering the indigenous culture of New Zealand. And so for me, that was a point of reading around more. I thought, well, is this the case? And I did some reading, and there were a few journal articles that were talking about colonization and knowledge of the land and indigenous culture in outdoor learning. And so I would not have been understanding of that viewpoint until I'd had that initial conversation and then did my own research to find out, is this actually happening? And so it is important to look at multiple sources of information. And I think that then gives us a more credibility and more validity, because we have more evidence if we had to argue a case or we had to put something forward that was important for the way we work, or perhaps something that we're investigating.
Thanks, Gemma. That's really, really interesting. And one of the things that I found really interesting there is the acknowledgement that the limitations in research are not actually something that is a weakness. It's actually a strength if you can identify those limitations to what you're exploring. And the next question I was going to ask you, Gemma, if that's okay, is what does evidence-informed practice actually look like day to day in an early year setting? How do we bring that back to the ground? What does that look like?
Yeah, again, we collect evidence every day. And I think sometimes we forget that we are researchers all the time in practice. You know, we're finding out about the lives of the children that we work with. We're exploring ways of giving them the most positive early experiences that they can have while they spend time with us. And some children, it might be a very short time they're with us. Others might be with us all the way from small babies until they're getting ready to leave to go to school. And so evidence-informed practice, again, gives credibility, but it also strengthens practice. So we, regardless of the roles and responsibilities that we have, I say everybody that works in a setting or early childhood service will be collecting some form of evidence. And once again, this could be your observations, it could be the plans, the evaluations, your notes from meetings with families, your notes from meetings with colleagues and external parties as well. And when we get this information, I think it can be easy to almost like just put it in a drawer and forget about it. But this evidence is really important, and it can be crucial in particular scenarios with children. And so I remember visiting a setting years ago, and it was for an early years teacher, and we were doing the tour of the setting, and she showed me this very small notebook, and it had a child's name on it. And I said, oh, what's this? And she said, it was a little notebook where children could share their worries. And each child had a little worry book, and they would write down a child's worries. So if a child was concerned about something, or if they had a nightmare, or something frightened them, they would keep a record of it. And I was curious as to why. And she said, sometimes it is very rare. This could be a sign of something more sinister potentially happening in that child's life. So if they're having a nightmare about somebody's taking them away, or they are frightened of something or a person, it could mean that there is something happening in the life of that child. And this was capturing the child's words, discussions, conversations they'd had with the adults. And it was kept very discreetly as well. It wasn't like on display for everybody. It was put away in a filing cabinet very discreetly, but it was used as evidence in case there was potentially something happening in that child's life. So the evidence there was quite unusual at the time. I mean, I expect there might be more record keeping processes now, because this is going back probably to about, I think, 2012, 2013. So using that evidence could potentially have lasting impacts for a child that could be at risk, or something that could be happening to that child. And so we have that pool of evidence. The rest of the evidence we get will often come through the latest news and research. So, you know, we have our trade magazines that we can access, that give us, you know, practical advice, but they also do give us updates on discoveries being made in the sector, what's happening out there. And it's important to take into account, what impact does that have on us? So if inspection processes change, for example, then, you know, do we need to think about evidence that we collect to show the quality of our provision and practice? Do we need to perhaps rethink how much evidence we collect? Because, again, we might be in situations where we over-collect information because we feel we have to, but we don't always spend that time analysing it, scrutinising it, and understanding how this information is going to support us in our practice. So whatever we collect does have value, but it's also important to think about how we use it moving forward.
So part of the endpoint assessment for my EYSLA learners, the earlier senior leaders, is to create a strategic business proposal. And that's something we've been discussing this past month. It's what our first podcast was about as well. So I'm just thinking, because I've spent a lot of time talking to them about the research that they need to use to inform their strategic decisions. So what kind of questions should leaders be asking themselves before they're using research to inform these strategic decisions? And how can they use the research to inform their strategic decisions that are going to have a lasting impact on their settings?
I think the biggest piece of advice is to have a focus. And I think it's important to have sometimes a less is more approach. So we cannot, as always, tackle huge, enormous projects and ideas. We may have to take smaller steps to get to that point. So, something that we do on the postgraduate course I teach is an action research module. And in that module, the students choose a micro change. So they select something that they would change or could change in practice. And this might be something as simple as supporting children from a younger age group transition to the next room. It could be something more ambiguous, such as introducing an anti-racism policy. And through that, they set out one cycle of action research. So it's almost like a first phase. And this requires them to choose a specific focus. If it's too broad, it becomes unmanageable, and then they get confused and there's lots of complexities around it. So for any starting point, particularly with a strategic decision, it's about, I say, a stepping stone approach. It's thinking about, what is the focus? Why is it needed? You know, what are we intending to do? Is it because it's going to lead into a bigger change further down the line? Is it an urgent change or priority, something perhaps we need to do quite quickly? I'd say we don't research for research's sake. It can be quite easy to say, oh, we've got to research because we have to do it as part of our course. I think the mindset has to be, we're researching because we want to evolve, we want to develop, we want to improve. And so thinking about intentions, you know, what are they going to be looking for and why? it's important to be open-minded, because again, we might have an assumption about the way things are done, about the way things are working, and that might come through our own biases and experiences, and we may not necessarily have the full picture. And so we need to collect as much evidence as we can to help us inform our decision-making processes. And sometimes it might be about looking at other practice. It might be thinking about an idea that we have and thinking, has anybody else done this before? And if they have, where can I find information on that? And could this idea be adapted for the setting? And if so, how could we adapt it? And this goes back to something that happened when I started working, is settings were very reluctant to share good practice when I started working, because there was a worry that ideas would be stolen or that staff would be poached. And I know there were a few cases where staff were poached for sort of a more tempting offers of pay and career progression. And it was a shame, because it felt we were in our bubble. We didn't get to see other examples of good practice. We didn't have some of the organizations or events that are out there now where we could network and meet others and talk about what we're doing. And going to research conferences for me is an eye-opener, because people want to share what they're doing well. And it's not just academics and researchers. There's a growing number of practitioners coming to research conferences and talking about the wonderful things they are doing in practice and in their settings. And people ask them questions, you know, I would like to try this in my setting. How did you do this successfully? And so very small steps can actually lead to something much bigger down the line. But you do need to have a focus. You do need to have a reason or a rationale behind that change. It's not always a good idea to have change for change's sake, because people can be very reluctant or resistant to it. And it draws back to the whole conversation we've had about evidence. You need to build a case as to why this decision has been made, why this change is occurring. And it can be very challenging to do that, because people will have comfortable ways of working or comfortable ways of doing things and may be quite frightened or nervous about anything that's going to make their work different or potentially more challenging. And so I think having that evidence base is very important, because it builds a stronger case for change and also for those strategic decision-making processes.
Excellent. Yep.
Absolutely. I think that's really interesting, and it does give you that mindset of how it can be sort of risky to jump on those trends and to kind of go on those, you know, we do get the lovely magazines that come through that have got lovely articles in, and it does seem really, really positive and you want to give it a try.
Or TikTok.
T-shirt
trends we can't ignore.
But I think that really does solidify the importance of really having that deeper understanding of that change that you're trying and the reason behind it, why. So how does ongoing analysis actually support a culture of learning and improvement rather than just blame?
I think it's about a shift in thinking. I have been in settings before where sadly there has been a blame culture, or I've heard from others about settings having a blame culture. And it's extremely toxic. It can be extremely harmful. Sometimes people actually leave childcare in early years for good, because it's just been very challenging to work at a setting that has the mindset of blame. And so I think it's more of, it's something that's quite nice. It's about sort of strength-based resilience as well. It's about, we have all these challenges coming our way in the context of the way we work. You know, there are things that we have to do that are legal requirements. There are difficult decisions we sometimes have to make. There are challenges with funding. There's recruitment and retention issues as well. We have increasing need amongst families and children that go beyond what we used to have when I started my career working with children. And I think much of this is about the ethos of the setting. And it's a collective ethos where everybody understands what direction practice is moving in and why. And so this often requires a huge cultural shift in thinking. And blame, as I said, can harm relationships, and it can also greatly harm confidence. It can make educators and practitioners doubt themselves. They might be questioning themselves every 5 minutes. They might be trying to please people. So it can have a deep ingrained impact if there is that whole blame culture in that setting. And so perhaps this is, again, another opportunity for thinking to change and also our approaches to work change. And considering evidence and context. So rather than if somebody does something wrong or makes a mistake, why did that happen? And it might be something as simple as the person may not have had all the information on something. So, you know, you might have a student or a new member of staff that comes into the setting that's just expected to do things a more experienced practitioner would do. They might find they're working with a child that has a particular need, but nobody has told them about that child's particular need. So they might do something where it could cause a risk, or it could disrupt that child's day, or it could disrupt practice in some way. And it can be very easy to turn away and say, well, you did this wrong, you didn't read this policy, or didn't do that, rather than think, well, why? When did this happen? What's actually happened? So the person might come to you and say, you know, I didn't realise this child actually has sensory processing disorder, for example. You know, like, you know, they were getting very anxious because we were playing loud music and the child was covering their ears. And it's not the fault of the practitioner. It's the lack of evidence, the lack of information that they've been given. So it's about thinking, well, how can we perhaps mitigate this? How could we minimise this of happening again? What alternatives are there in terms of supporting someone that perhaps does find it difficult in an early years setting? Do we need to think about something more collectively? Perhaps we need to approach things a different way. Are there people that could come in and help? So could someone model some practice or model a particular interaction that somebody else could then try out themselves and then reflect on it? And this actually forms part of an assessment I do with postgraduates, where they choose an incident or event of something that's actually happened in practice. And it could be something really nice that's happened, such as helping a child or family. Or it could be something more challenging, such as people misunderstanding the roles and responsibilities of a bank, you know, bank staff that come in for a temporary period of time. And so what we do is we have them write this incident up in as much detail as they can remember. And then we use COPE cycle of experiential learning, and we use it almost as like a little stepping stone to then explore this particular event. So first of all, they look back at the incident and they try and think, why did things happen the way they did? And are there reasons behind it? And it's not about blaming. So if they were working with a more challenging member of staff, they're completely discouraged from saying anything negative about that person, because we don't know why that person responded that way. So we think about what could be happening. It might be that person doesn't have the information. It might be they were stressed. It might be they didn't realise that there were some things that student wasn't meant to be doing at the time and just expected them to work a certain way. And so we start to then do some reading around that. What impact does that have on us as professionals? It might be to do with a need to be more resilient. It might be a need to become more confident in their profession. It might even be able to do with their identity. You know, perhaps people don't understand their roles or responsibilities enough. How can they communicate to that in a different way? And then we think a bit wider. You know, is this something that could happen to others? And what would have been helpful at the time that I could have used? So in some cases, students come to me and say, I didn't have an induction at my setting. And, you know, if I had had a mentor there, someone that could have explained these things to me, I might have felt a little bit more confident working in a very busy classroom or with a very chaotic playroom where there was a high number of very young children that they hadn't had experience with before. So they perhaps had been with the preschoolers and now they were toddlers and babies, and they find it more chaotic because they just haven't had that experience with the age group. And then we finally get to a sort of a strategy point where we think, what could be put in place for somebody else going through that experience like me. And this may be about drawing on the resources that we have where we would actively put something in place. And again, mentoring, supervision, better inductions for people, signposting them to other things that would help them in their role. So that might include doing some reading and research. So if they have a more, perhaps a member of staff that doesn't accept new ideas very openly, then they have evidence to say why the idea might work and encourage them to pilot the idea or test it out. So that is something that they not only just do on the module, but they actually take those skills out afterwards. And as we go through our studies and learning, we often come back to that point of, you know, how can we sustain these changes and how can we maintain change, but in a positive way that will also be a positive modelling for more inexperienced members of staff. And it's not uncommon for us to have learners join us who are very experienced, where they might have worked with multiple partners in multiple settings, that still come and join the course to say, I want to be better at what I do. Because there might be a particular challenge and they've not yet quite been able to figure out how to tackle it until we start talking about things like analysis, evaluation, and evidence base. And that can be quite transformative for them.
And not just leading that back again to that strategic thinking and that strategic planning of leaders is using that evaluation to create sustainable improvement, which is what All About Strategy is about, the long-term impact and lasting impact. Gemma, I can't thank you enough for being here with us today. I have really enjoyed our conversation. I think that our listeners are going to get a lot out of it. So thank you so much for that. Really appreciate that.
No, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. It really has. So
thank you.
Oh, thank you, Zuma. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you could leave a review or a comment of your on your favorite podcast platform, then that helps us to spread the word and improve the quality of early years apprenticeships. You can also contact us via podcast@bestpracticenet.co.uk if you have any feedback or suggestions for the show, and we may revisit them in future episodes. Come on, join the conversation. What are your thoughts on today's discussion? Do you have any questions or insight for others that you'd like to share? Let us know. So that's all for this episode. So until next time, take care and goodbye.